This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 137.
If customer-centric is about price, that would be not so great because that comes out of my margin. If it's all about price, then that will not really help with gaining a competitive advantage. But despite the fact that customers care about price, customer centricity is all about improving the experience. And again, as a result, you can charge more money. And I think the same is true for the other side of the value stack. Motivating and engaging your employees is not increasing the wage necessarily, but improving the employee experience. And as a result, the cost per unit actually goes down because people are more engaged and more motivated. So they're more productive. They're more innovative. They actually either on process or they actually create new products. They're less likely to leave, so quit rates are going to go down. And last but not least, happy employees make happy customers. I don't think there is any organization where the customer is happy and the employees are miserable.
How can you create a more employee-centric culture? Why do companies that invest in employee experience consistently outperform their competitors? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott. And this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. Imagine having direct access to 18 world-class thought leaders who will elevate and transform how you think about HR. As many of you know, late last year, I launched Elevate, a three-week virtual development experience that over 100 HR leaders attended and participants described as a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost and by far the most engaging learning experience in years. Elevate 2025 returns on May 20th, and it's specifically designed to elevate HR business partners and Center of Excellence professionals' strategic capabilities and business impact. Who will you learn from at Elevate? We're talking Dave Ulrich on the next agenda for HR, Muriel Wilkins on breaking through limiting beliefs, Mark Efron on connecting talent philosophy to business strategy, plus sessions on AI-driven process redesign, Agile HR, top team effectiveness, operating model transformation, how to communicate like an executive, what your CEO actually wants from HR, and how to get your expertise actually used. Every session is designed with the goal of helping you to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. Also, the 16 interactive sessions include live Q&A, where your specific challenges and questions get addressed by the expert themselves. And with recorded sessions and slides available afterwards, you don't have to worry about missing a session, or even better, you and your team can revisit these insights again and again. So what are you waiting for? Register now or learn more at www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr. Or go to futureofhr.com. But hurry, as early bird pricing is available for only a limited time. Don't miss this once a year chance to transform your capabilities and career at Elevate 2025. And with that, my guest this week is Stefan Meyer. Stefan is currently the chair of the management division and James P. Gorman professor of business at the Columbia Business School. He holds a PhD in economics from the University of Zurich and was previously a senior economist at the Center for Behavioral Economics and Decision-Making at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. His research interest is in behavioral strategy, and he investigates the impact of psychology and economics on human decision-making. And most recently, Stefan has written a new and important book, The Employee Advantage: How Putting Workers First Helps Business Thrive. And in The Employee Advantage, Stefan argues that organizations must value their employees as much as, if not more than, their customers. And those companies that pivot towards an employee-centric model will be more profitable, innovative, and attract the best talent. This is a great conversation. I know you're going to learn a lot as we discussed why employees care about more than just money when it comes to their jobs, the same way customers care about more than just price, how investing in employee experience drives innovation, reduce costs, and significantly boosts retention, why designing just right challenges that stretch but don't overwhelm employees is crucial for engagement, and how strategic choices around generative AI can enhance rather than diminish human contribution and engagement, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Stefan. Stefan, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, JP.
Well, thank you for being with us. Excited about our conversation to hear about your book, your experiences. And I want to start off by asking you, you spent years studying human motivation, organizational performance. What was the aha moment that led you to write this book about treating employees as the new customers?
Yeah, thank you so much, JP. I mean, it's actually funny. I did for years study human motivation. And for years, I do teach business strategy. And for years, I kept those pretty separate. I'll go into the classroom and teach about what should Walmart do? How can Disney get an edge? Should PepsiCo spin off their snacks division and stuff? And then go back to my office and study, how do we make the human experience better? What are people motivated? And I haven't really put it together that much for the longest time. I have to tell, like during the pandemic, somehow that was a moment where I thought, like, first of all, it put like a bright spotlight on stuff that is not working in the workplace. It was not working before, but somehow this disruption really led to it became pretty obvious. And then I also became the chair of the management division. So I actually managed a couple of people and thought like, oh, this is really hard. And so then I actually put those two together. And thirdly, I started to teach elective on the future of work and also thought like how technology affects organization and affects the people aspects within an organization. So that then led me to combine all those three things, you know, thought about not in silos about what motivates people, but how can that be used as a competitive advantage? So that's kind of the business strategy and what does technology do in order to enhance or destroy those human motivation within the organization.
Oh, it's great that you kind of had that moment. I think you're right. Sometimes we look at business strategy a little bit, forgive me for saying academically, right? Without thinking about how you can make that happen and how important having the right talent or capabilities or culture is to do that. And a lot of that does come back to how you treat employees, right? And
absolutely.
There are organizations that do this really well, but I've always heard, you know, there's the three legs of the stool. It's all about employees, customers, and shareholders, right? Delivering value for all three. But at times, I feel like it does get weighted. You know, the stool sort of tilts to one side or the other. So I'm glad we get a chance to talk about your book.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, like when, and we might talk later a little bit about the framework I'm using when I teach strategy. But the customer, as you said, customers are important, employees are important in order to create value for the organization. And then I started looking at how often do employee executives talk about customers or employees? And they talk about it like 10 times more about customers than employees. In fact, it's increasing. That's the average over the last decade. It actually increased to about 14%. And then I looked at what's like the background of board members? How many board members have marketing backgrounds and how many have people background? And again, you see that discrepancy. Then I said, like, oh, what about textbooks and strategy, the field that I teach? Again, there, while there are the three stools, one of the legs, actually two, the shareholder is a really, really long leg and the customer is getting longer and longer and the employees is actually still a little bit neglected.
Yeah, it's such an unfortunate situation, right? But I love that you went back and looked at actual basic announcements by public CEOs on their quarterly or annual results saying, hey, we're talking about customers versus employees. So that's really interesting. And I think a lot of companies really adopt this either or approach, this notion of we're either employee focused or going to be customer focused to maximize profits, our shareholders, et cetera. But we can't do both. Like, why is there zero-sum thinking? Why can't we have a little more balanced view in corporations?
Yeah, I completely agree with you, JP, that there is a lot of either-or thinking. And I argue in the book that that's a kind of the first mindset shift that needs to happen. And why there is decay, either zero sum is like comes really natural to us. I think that's just the human nature. I take something from you, it comes from you. The pie is growing doesn't come as natural. But I think when we thought about customers, we actually understood that there is a growing pot. I can make my customers really, really happy and make a lot of money. Now, obviously, if it were just the price, that would be different. If we negotiate over the price, I give you a better price that comes out of my margin. But if I help you to have a better experience, that increases the premium aspect of the product, you know, makes you more loyal. And as a result, I can actually charge more money. And I think the same is true with when we think about employees. When there are customers involved, I think there is even more of this winning strategy. So let's think Starbucks. The new CEO of Starbucks has to turn around the company. Part of what Starbucks was losing is kind of the vibe in their stores. It was like this third place. You would go in there, hang out and consume, feel welcomed. And then they went, in my view, a little overboard with really customer-centric. You can customize your latte in like 5,000 different ways. And they forgot that a huge part of what makes a Starbucks this third place is the people in the Starbucks. The baristas are critically important. And they were from the very beginning. I think that was the whole, it was part of their strategy. One of the three-legged stools was like, to deal with their barista, and that helped to create that amazing atmosphere in the Starbucks. And then they were losing it. And I think in order to get back to it, they need to be employee-centric, treat their baristas better. And as a result, the customers are actually happier. So I think the pie is going to increase. And then thirdly, they're going to make more money. So the shareholder will actually benefit as well.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Starbucks. I'm rooting for them to turn it around. I think they will. There's a little bit of complexity added to the stores with all the customizations. I mean, there's a hidden menu. My daughter, we downloaded an app one time to find out this hidden menu. And, you know, it's a lot of stress on the baristas. And I think they also made a big push with kind of the efficiency piece on the mobile ordering, which is really helpful, but does take you out of that experience of kind of getting to know the barista, seeing their waiting. So I do think they'll turn it around. I think Starbucks is a great company, and I'm excited to see them do that. I was actually there today, so... supporting yes. Starbucks.
I think like the initial communication, at least from the new CEO, are that they are actually going to go back to the basics. And I think that involves a little bit less complexity, which means a little bit less options. Maybe you can't customize it in 5,000 ways, but only in 1,000 ways. And that then also affects the experience that the baristas has, which will lead them to better customer experience as a result.
The main point you're making, though, right, is around companies that understand how they're creating value, and the employee, the barista, has always been the partner, they call there at Starbucks, has always been core to that model. And I do think they've done a lot. I've actually had Sarah Kelly, who's a CPO for Starbucks, on there, and they are really focused on, but more than a lot of other companies, on doing that. But I think you've got to make sure that everything else fits around there, that kind of systems thinking, right? So I'm excited to see where they go with that. Let's talk more about your book, though, because you talk about this moving from customer centricity to employee centricity. You have this concept of the value stick, which I thought was really interesting. It's a framework that visually represents the balance of value between a company, its customers, and its employees. Tell us more about this value stick concept and how it works.
If you think about how you, in competition, you're a firm and you compete against one of your main competitor. Now, let's say you have exactly the same product. You're in the bazaar. And you're selling the same product in one stall versus the other, everything that happens then is price competition leads to prices going to go down to almost cost. So the margins are going to be very, very low. So what really differentiates companies if they create more value, they're doing something differently. And you can be different on two fronts. The top part of this value stick, which I visualize as like this literally a vertical stick that's like on top, has the willingness to pay of the customer. How willing are they to pay for this? They don't pay that. They pay the price. And then what goes to the customer is kind of their happiness and joy for that. Then is price and cost. That's kind of the margin. And on the lower end of this value stick is everything from the supplier, labor being a really important part. What's the experience what's the willingness to supply or the reservation wage or the whatever people are willing as the workforce willing to put in. And we can, in order to differentiate from competition, we can either increase the willingness to pay, get the customer experience up and make that better, or improve on the other side, which is the employee experience. Now, critically important there, as I said before, if customer-centric is about price, that would be not so great because that comes out of my margin. If it's all about price, then that will not really help with gaining a competitive advantage. But despite the fact that customers care about price, customer centricity is all about improving the experience. And again, as a result, you can charge more money. And I think the same is true for the other side of the value stack. Motivating and engaging your employees is not increasing the wage necessarily, but improving the employee experience. And as a result, the cost per unit actually goes down because people are more engaged and more motivated. So they're more productive. They're more innovative. They actually either on process or they actually create new products. They're less likely to leave. So quit rates are going to go down. And last but not least, it actually affects the willingness to pay. You know, as we talked before about Starbucks, happy employees make happy customers. I don't think there is any organization where the customer is happy and the employees are miserable when they have direct contact between the employees. So that's how I think about strategy. And I mentioned before that in my strategy class, I always kept it somehow separate. I talked a lot about the top part of the value stack, how to increase the willingness to pay, how to differentiate by being customer-centric. And I kind of neglected somehow the bottom part. And now I'm talking much more about part of how do you create value is having really motivated, engaged employees. And that's a crucial aspect of having a competitive advantage as an organization.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Stefan. Are you ready to take your career to the next level? If you are, then you need to download the HR Leaders Blueprint, featuring battle-tested strategies from over 100 HR thought leaders and CHROs. This comprehensive 18-page guide delivers actionable steps, strategic frameworks, and real-world insights to elevate your impact. No theoretical fluff, just proven tactics to becoming a business-focused HR leader. And the best part, it's completely free. To download the HR Leaders Blueprint, go to futureofhr.com. That's futureofhr.com. And if you want to get a jumpstart on your 2025 career goals, then you do not want to miss out on the HR Leaders Blueprint. Our companies, when they think about how they create competitive value, almost ignoring the employee factor, because they're saying, well, we're really focused on this value we create for this customer in this way. And yes, our employees, of course, help deliver that, but maybe it's not as direct. You know, there's a capability we're bringing and methodology, something that's proprietary. And it's almost like we focus exclusively on that value creation, the business side of what we're doing for that customer that's so unique, that makes us stand out in the bazaar, as you put it, but not, oh, hey, our employees are the ones that have better talent, better capabilities, better ideas. How do you see that? Because I feel like a lot of companies, that's what we're focused on. We're talking about what are the levers we pull on that customer side, right?
Yeah. It just comes a little bit more natural to think about the customer, but it's also, this is a little new. First of all, not every company who says they care about the customer, which are 100% of the companies, are actually customer-centric. It needs a little more than just to say we care about customers. And when you think about the customer centricity, back in the days before customer centricity was product centric, we would design. I thought, like, let me talk to my engineering team. What's like the best gadget they could make with most all the bells and whistles that my engineering team can do? And then we were selling it, pushing it onto the customer. And then customer centricity comes around and I was like, let's maybe ask the customer what they want. And maybe they don't want all those buttons. You know, in fact, Apple did one button. I'm sure they were able to create a gadget that has more than one buttons, but they figured out actually we reduce it to the max. So it's what the customer really, really wants and do really well about that. And I think we have to now do that with the employees as well. But it's a lot of work. It needs this mindset shift. a quote that I really enjoy that Bezos, Jeff Bezos said, Amazon a really customer-centric organization. And he said, you know what is great about the customers? They're always dissatisfied. And they're so dissatisfied that I always have to think about how to do better. Keeps me on the toes. That's what we think about because, you know, we want to figure out like what is not working and then improve. Now, how do we think about our employees being dissatisfied? I think very few think like, that's an awesome opportunity to improve. They think like, oh, that sucks. Now, you know, now there's this, now I have to do more work. But I think if we want to shift from to those employee centricity, we have to think about it in the exact same way. There is now innovation we can do on the people front where we can improve. And asking people about this, getting constant feedback, involving them is part of the process. But instead of, if you would talk to a marketing executive and say, like, is it a good idea to ask your customer once a year how they're doing? They would like laugh their asses off. You know, they was like, of course not. I need constant feedback, focus group, customer journeys, and so on. But that's kind of what we do with our employees. We ask them once a year how they're doing. We don't really want to know the answer because it's often like then we have to do something. Everybody knows about that, so nobody actually participates in the annual engagement surveys in the first place. But I think we need to change that dramatically.
Yeah. When you think about HR and organizations, there's a very wide continuum, right? And I think the most progressive and large organizations are really looking at how they do real-time sentiment analysis and understanding. And I think a lot of companies are moving even more than just the annual, but where I think you're right, Stefan, the hard part is how do we shift and change the work to meet the needs of our employees in a meaningful way under typically some pretty big constraints and a profitability in terms of how that company operates. And I think that's been one of the challenges. That's what HR really, I think, is trying to do. And I know you talked about, I really love this part of the book, you talked about four key factors of how humans work, almost needs that we all have. So purpose, autonomy, just right tasks, which I would love you to talk more about, and social connections. But talk to us about how we can leverage these tools to help really be more employee-centric and maybe design something that's getting past this dissatisfiers, as we talked about.
Absolutely. I think it's critically important to take like the science, and we actually know a lot about like how humans work. So that's kind of that part in the book where I talk about what motivates people and then think about like, how can we do that differently? So let me just give an example. So you mentioned just right tasks. So I'm going to talk about that quickly. I started with that story about my son. When my son was little, he needed to read 30 minutes a day. That was a requirement from the school. He had to log it. And I cannot tell you how much we fought over those 30 minutes every single day. I was like, you know, and I would tell like, dude, just come home, read 30 minutes, and then you can do whatever you want. You can play FIFA for the rest of the evening. I don't care. You just have to read 30 minutes. He was just not doing it. And it was a real struggle until one day he like pulled me into a bookstore. And so I'm like, Dad, I want to buy this box of books. And I was like, wow, this is like holidays on steroids. Yeah, absolutely. Like, and real books, not about soccer, which he was really interested in, not picture books, like real books. It was a book series by Dan Goodman, Weird School series. It was just right for his level. So what was really motivating for him, and I think it's very universal, is that when your skills are optimally challenged, you're not underwhelmed or reading a baby book in his terminology, and you're not overwhelmed when he wanted to read Harry Potter when he was six and got frustrated. You're like optimally challenged. That's extremely motivating. Now, after he was done with The Weird School, you know, The Weird School book became a baby book. So he had to move on. So he actually found a new series. He was then reading Stuart Gibbs's Spy School series. So he was reading that for a while. He then stopped reading a lot, but we had a good run. What is very universally true that people are very motivated when their skills are used optimally. And a lot of people actually leave because they're stuck. You know, they don't learn anything. They don't learn new skills. They're underwhelmed. Now, the problem is a little bit, I jokingly tell to my executives that I teach, now that you know that, it's easy. You just have to find out for each of your employee, what's the just right task, match it with the right tasks, and constantly update. Because giving JP the right task, and then JP knows, eventually becomes a master and then gets bored, I need to show him more. I say, like, that's all you need to do. Now they all laugh. It's like, well, this is hard. You know, this is hard if you have a 5-person team. This is impossible if you have like a 100-person team. And then I tell them, and that's kind of another part where I then tell, you know, what can technology now do? And if that sounds a little bit like a task for AI, because it is, that's what Netflix does in a different domain. It figures out, oh, Stefan watches like nature documentaries and JP watches like history documentaries. And then they showed you more history. They show me more nature. And then once I'm done, you know, there's only that much nature you can watch. If I move on, the system will know. Oh, it's like, oh, Stefan actually now watches more history. Let's show him more history. And JP moved on to drama. And so it constantly updates and personalizes it in a very meaningful way. And there are ways of doing so. So those internal marketplaces, technologies that are gaining momentum do exactly that. They kind of figure out what are like the skills or project that I want to work on, matches it with the right project, and constantly learns and updates. I think that's one of the ways where you can take this foundation of what motivates people, think about how the skills have to evolve, and use technology to enhance and not destroy those motivators.
Yeah, it's a really great example of the idea of being challenged and stretched just enough to continue to grow. You know, it's interesting, you're talking, you've got purpose and autonomy, even social connections probably come into play a little bit, because a lot of organizations we have moved to saying you own, as the employee, your own development. And a lot of employees, I think, and team members feel like that is a cop-out, right? Like, well, I own my own development and you're not going to help me. But part of that is because I think we realize that a lot of the just right tasks is really inside your head. I don't know where you're at each time. And our managers are very poor at this because they have their own tasks to get done and they're trying to figure out how they grow. So I think technology can really help that. But how does purpose and autonomy play into this and someone taking accountability for some of this? Yeah. Or like your son did, hey, now I'm ready to read books. It's on his terms, not because it's being dictated to him.
Yeah, that's an important point, JPM. Maybe I go a little bit back what you said before. I think the misconception is a little bit, if I empower or if I give autonomy, then it's all up to you. And I think it's, if you think about, you know, what leaders can do, they can be very frequently involved and can do it for control or give autonomy. And the problem a little bit is that a lot of leaders think about autonomy of stepping back. Because what you don't want is being the micromanager, constantly involved in order to control. But I think in order to set up empowerment for success, you probably need to be more involved, not to control, but to support, giving more understanding what skills are actually needed in the organization, being more transparent, helping employees to use the new gained autonomy, empowerment, in a way that is actually aligned with the organization. And that probably needs more involvement from leaders and not less, but not to control, but actually to support. Now, you bring up another aspect, is, you know, how much has to be on, does the organization need to free up also capacity and like support the employees to do the work, be it upskilling, working on extra projects and whatever. And I think it doesn't work if I just say, well, you have the weekends to do, I empower you to do whatever you want, ideally work-related, on the weekend or on the, that of course doesn't work. It needs to be aligned with the business. Everybody needs to understand that it actually helps not the individual only, but the organization as well. And then there is a shared responsibility on how and when we do that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think organizations have to really be thoughtful about this and building in people to really grow and develop on the job. And I think we'll talk more about technology because I think it can help us now. We're in a place where we are going to get those kind of recommendations on learning development, and even projects and gig work is starting to happen, which is great. But I did want to ask you, Stefan, some companies, as you know, are really profitable despite treating employees poorly. And what's your message to leaders who point to these examples as justification for not becoming more employee-centric?
Yeah, that's a hard one because there is always the exception to the rules. There are countries who are very successful and dictatorships. Now, does that mean that democracies are not good? No, I think on average, that's what I believe. Treating employees nicely and caring about the employees creates a more motivated, more productive, and as a result, more successful organization. There are always those exceptions that prove the rule. But I hear that whenever I talk about it, people always come up with like, what about Tesla? What about Amazon? What about those examples where it's different? And yeah, those examples exist. But I think like they're the exception. And I do think that the trends are leading towards those who really care will really thrive. Because I guess we talk about technology in a second, but I now have so many discussions when it's technology where somehow people issues become important. We just had a conference last week here at Columbia Business School about AI and finance. I think if we would have had like the technology and finance 15 years ago, that would be like on the product, you know, what do we do with crypto and whatever. I mean, there was a lot of talk about people issues, rightly so, because how do we implement it? How do we transform the organization? How do we think about people issues? And I think they're becoming more and not less important. And I think those organizations who neglect those will just not survive in competition.
Yeah, it's interesting. And my message to CEOs that are still profitable, maybe aren't treating their employees as well as they could, because I know those HR leaders in those companies are trying very hard to make sure all the right things, is how much better could you be and how much could lower turnover be? And if you look at companies that have been on the Fortune 500 list from like 2000 to now, half that list is gone. These companies don't exist anymore. And so I think companies that really stand the test of time have figured a way to not only have competitive advantage, but have an employee advantage.
That's right. The problem, JP, is if you want to increase the profits tomorrow, cutting labor and squeezing out more is the easiest and fastest way to do that in the short term. I also believe it's the best way to destroy the long-term value of the organization. But in the short run, that's really easy. I think the people-centric or employee-centric strategy is a more mid to long-term strategy. I mean, as is actually quite frankly true with customer centricity as well. If you want to cut costs tomorrow, you get rid of the marketing budget, you stop branding or whatever. But in the long run, that's not a good idea. And I think the same is true. You have to be a little bit more forward-looking than like the quarterly results.
Let's talk about technology because we've kind of talked a lot about this. And I had one really big, broad question, but I'd love to hear what you're seeing this in terms of impacting the employee piece, was just really around how do you see the employee experience changing over the next 5 years with AI? But I'd also love to hear your perspective on customers as well, just in the world, because it's going to hit all of us, right?
Technology is, and AI in particular, and is a big topic, obviously, on everybody's mind right now. Now, I do think the problem with technology is like you can deploy it in a way that like destroys human motivation quite dramatically. Think about like all those surveillance technologies that deployed nowadays on people who work remotely, you know, take screenshots, watch like that your bubble is green and so on and so forth. I mean, that kills the trust aspect, which is a key part of the autonomy piece. And or like replacement, if you're just using AI to just replace people and like cost efficiency is on top of your mind, then I think it's not going to help the human motive. In fact, it destroys it. You have to think about it very differently, that technology can really enhance those motivators. And in some, it might be more obvious. When you think about purpose or meaningful work, a lot of stuff we do is stupid, is boring. I don't want to write meeting summaries. I hate it. In fact, it takes away from me having more interpersonal relations, having actually the meetings that I should have. And if we can use technology to augment what I'm doing, automate some of the tasks that I should not be doing that are not value enhancing in order to free up capacity for stuff that I should be doing, then I think it really can create value. Think about wealth management. The financial advisor, if you look at all the tasks the financial advisor does, he or she gets up in the morning, then like reads the news, you know, figures out like what's the market going to look like and see how does JP's portfolio look like? How do I need to suggest to him? Then he or she has lunch with the potential new clients. Then he or she sends you an email, then has phone call with a new other client to figure out. Now, when you look at those tasks, most of them, the machine can do better. You know, the machine doesn't get up because it already looked at the news, can figure out all the product in the organization, can like figure out what's more ideal for your portfolio, knows exactly your risk profile by looking at the choices you made, and so on. The only thing that it can't do as well, at least until now, is having lunch, play golf, have like meaningful conversations with clients. And when Morgan Stan, and that's why we were worried so much about like robot advising, those robots, do they take over? And then I think the forward-looking organizations that I just wrote a case about Morgan Stanley's wealth management, think about AI as a tool that can help their financial advisors to be better, to actually have more lunches. The head AI at Morgan Stanley, Jeff McMillan, says, in order for them to have more lunches, have more phone calls, have more of those human aspects to it, and then somebody, the AI, suggests an email that they should send. They analyze all the choices, so it augments kind of the humans. But you have to be very deliberate about this. As a leader, you have to think about, like, how can I actually free up capacity from my employees, not in order to replace, but in order for them to actually do new and more value-enhancing activities.
Yeah, great example, Stefan. I think this idea of augmenting human capabilities is where we're hopefully all goes. I think it'll be really interesting to see, but that's why HR really needs to be in the forefront of helping the business leaders think this through.
Right.
Because I think, as you talked about that example, what's really clear is we have to make decisions from leadership and management on how we design the work, where AI plays, where it doesn't play, how it augments human behavior for competitive advantage.
Right.
Because you can have a Morgan Stanley competitor that everything's AI, all the way through to an AI avatar that you have lunch with that may not do as well in the real world, right? How it all plays out. But those are all management decisions along the way.
Right.
And so I think organizations have a lot of choices to make as that technology continues to get better over the next few years on how they play. And it's no longer just talent and capabilities. The capabilities now is AI and technology and how that gets deployed, which I think will be wild to see.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is what you say, JB. We have a choice. And sometimes I feel we over-index so much on technology, it sometimes comes our way as if like there is this wave and we can't do anything. It just comes over and we have to react. But we actually have a choice how to deploy it, how to do it. And I think HR professionals are key in doing so. And I know we're talking for a long time that there is now is the pivotal moment where like HR becomes more important. But I really do think now is the time. I've never heard so many discussions with people who are not people, have no people background, now talk about humans. I think the future is going to be human-machine interaction, whatever we do. And so there is a human aspect in it. And who knows most about that? Those are people in HR. Even business leaders who never care, or they probably care, but they never spend enough time on thinking about all the people aspect, now care. Because if you don't, you're not implementing it in the right way, you don't do the right change management, transformation choices, you will actually not know what they're doing on a daily basis. So I think everybody now has to care much more about it than before.
Well said. Stefan, last question for you that I ask all my guests. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I do think what we talked about, that the employees are the new customers, I think that will resonate for a long time because it not only shows where the trend is going, but also where to look for tools. And I think we can look for tools in how we did customer centricity and apply this to employee centricity. I think it also helps for HR leaders how to talk about to their CEOs. And say, like, look, think about it. the same way as we did the shift to a customer centricity, and we just need to do the same for our employees.
I love it. Stefan, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, JP.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Stefan for sharing his insights and research from his new book, The Employee Advantage. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you will enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and elevate your business impact. Every Thursday, I'll drop in your inbox with one big idea that will get you thinking, two questions to challenge your perspective, and three actions you can take to level up your HR leadership game. Think of it as your weekly HR leadership booster shot, quick, powerful, and designed to help you put those ideas into practice immediately. And if you go to futureofhr.com to subscribe, be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with what I'm calling our Next Gen Disruptors series, which will feature two next-gen HR leaders who are doing innovative work to move our field forward. The Next Gen Disruptors series and conversations are designed to give you the ideas, tactics, and confidence to try these innovative ideas in your own organization. So don't miss next week's episode. And thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.